Well, session two, I did get word that the audio for last week did get posted to the web. I think that it is indeed linked to the calendar. And so if you miss a week, if you go to the church website and go to the calendar on Wednesday nights, this pastor's Bible study should be listed on the calendar. That entry on the calendar is a link. You can click it and it'll take you to the page where the audios are available. It will also eventually we'll get the notes available. And so if you miss the print notes and you want to pick up those, you can get those at the same location. Okay? It feels weird coming to this and not bringing a Bible. Every other semester we've done this, I've had to bring a Bible, and this time I just bring this book and my notes. So we're just kind of telling stories and talking through our history. One last time, if you came in late, we have books available. If you reserved one last week, they're back there for you, and we have extras. So if you didn't reserve one but would like one, Garrett is the keeper of the books. You can pay. It's kind of a choose your payment, anywhere from $12 to $20 for those. And that's not that there's any difference in the books. It's just we promised one price and they came in higher. So yes, sir. Thank you, John. I will. Up to tonight, I have read through chapter 9. All that. With that being said, next week's lecture is predominantly chapter 8. And so between now and next week, at the end of next week's session, we will have covered through the first 9 chapters. Fair enough. That's about 100 pages. I'm sorry? Yes, the Gonzalez book. The Dermot McCullough is, I mean, if you follow along with the other book, the same time period, the chronology is roughly the same, but he's much more verbose and the book is much longer. And so you ought to be able to just pick out the subjects and follow along if you're reading that book or any other, comparable book. So think about the church as we come to the end of the first century. So much that we take for granted. A tradition, systems of theology, denominational titles, heritage, print copies of the Bible readily accessible, all these things that we take for granted didn't exist. Christianity was basically a system of belief that was 1 to 2 generations old. And it had been built on the eyewitnesses. When we talk about the apostles, or the apostolic era of the church, we're talking about the eyewitnesses to Jesus' ministry, to his crucifixion, resurrection. Disciples, if you prefer. But by the time we get to 100, they're gone. The eyewitnesses are gone. And so we've moved into where the leaders of the church are second generation and not eyewitnesses. Didn't hear the teachings of Jesus firsthand. From the beginning of Acts, we kind of get the impression of the way the church spread out, but if you think in your mind, the different apostolic leaders had their own different communities, their circuit of churches that were influenced by them. Paul's circuit of influence we know very well because we have letters that he wrote to Philippi and Thessalonica and Corinth and Ephesus, many of these places. But Paul was only one of the leaders. And his circle of influence is only one circle of influence. John had his own circle of influence that was different from Paul's in different parts of the Roman world. Peter, the same. James, predominantly in Jerusalem, but also in other places. And we don't even know about the rest of the apostles. There are church tradition that suggests that James the disciple, brother of John, not James the brother of Jesus, that James the disciple managed to move to get all the way west to Spain. And there's part of church tradition that suggests that Thomas, the one of doubting faith, ended up carrying the gospel east as far away as India. And so all of these disciples had their different areas where they were influencing, and they didn't have any way to course. They had minimal ways of corresponding with one another. And all throughout this time period, they didn't have any traditions of belief or systematic theologies. They had the basic teachings of the gospel, the basic stories of Jesus, the parables of Jesus, stories about his miracles. They had the Hebrew scriptures, But they're left with a lot of questions. Okay, so now we're following Jesus and we know what he taught on these things, but here we are in Alexandria and these issues are coming up for us. What do we do? Basically, a lot of the questions we see Paul trying to answer for his churches had to have been asked in all of these other churches where Paul's letters didn't get to in the first 200 or 300 years of the church. And so you had the church trying to discover itself. Not at the core was settled, but in some of its ethics and some of its moral living, how it interacts with the culture around it, the church is trying to figure out how to operate as a relatively new system of belief, a new religion, which makes for a very interesting time in the church's history because we don't have apostles anymore. So who's in charge? You see the top of the notes, we refer to this period from 100 to 325 as the anti-Nicene period, okay? Anti with an E means, that's the Greek prefix, before. Anti with an I as a prefix means against. And so this is not against the Nicenes, this is before the Council of Nicaea. That'll be a watershed moment in the Roman Empire, in the Roman Church, that takes place in 325. And so we talk about the anti-Nicene period prior to 325, and then we'll have the post-Nicene period after the Council of Nicaea takes place. During this time period, we're going to look at, we'll spend about 3 weeks during the anti-Nicene period. The second century, spread of the church, new levels of persecution, new leaders rise, new heresies emerge. And then into the third, beginning of the third century, all the way through the third century, a whole other set of teachers and developments within the Roman Empire as Christianity goes from being a persecuted group of people to being the primary religion championed by the Roman Empire. It's pretty remarkable that this religion, that's a backwater group of laborers and farmers and slaves, within about 200 years is going to go from being the outcasts of an illegal religion in Rome to being the religion championed by Constantine the Emperor. And he says, this is the official religion of the empire. Remarkable. Some might say could only happen by the hand of God kind of creating a pathway for the early church to move. But it did not get there without a lot of blood spilt, without a lot of arguing and grumbling and complaining, without a lot of division, without a lot of heartache. But we can kind of see that as it takes place. The way I've divided the notes up tonight is predominantly to talk about what's going on in the church between the years 100 and 200, although some of the leaders you're going to see bleed over into the 200s. We're going to look at the spread of the church, just briefly, the spread of the church, which we've already alluded to, and how the growing numbers within the church is going to lead to a shifting identity, and with that, greater persecutions, and then how those persecutions were responded to by the church. They responded by defending themselves, not with weapons or not with swords, but with writings, with defending themselves with words, with theologies, and trying to help people understand who Christianity, what Christianity really is, what they really believed, and defend themselves in that way. So we start off here with the spread of the church. You see, by 200, the church had spread as far away as Spain in the west, India in the east, and possibly even into China. As a result, there weren't a whole lot of Jews living in Spain. There weren't Jews, if any, living in India. So as the church continues to grow around the Roman Empire and the known world, it's becoming more and more Gentile and less Jewish. And so that umbrella of Judaism that Christianity enjoyed for a while in the first century had already begun to evaporate. By the time we get into the second century, it's going to be completely gone. There's no misnomers that the Christian church is just a sect of Judaism. It's becoming more and more an independent, looks like more and more an independent religion because it's less and less Jewish, more and more Indian, Spanish, Germanic, Roman, Greek, Egyptian, wherever it is that the church had wandered to. The church also was predominantly urban during these years. Missionaries would go to major cities. And so you have, like I mentioned, with these apostles, you have hubs kind of situating in major metropolitan areas. Rome, of course, being one of those. Athens would be one. Alexandria in Egypt being one of those. Carthage, Lyon in what is modern-day France, or back then I think was referred to as Gaul, the Gallic Empire, Gallic nation. By the time we get to the Council of Nicaea 325, the Christian church has moved from the 12 disciples and the few followers at Pentecost to approximately 7 million adherents. Not a bad growth ratio, huh? That's roughly 300 years. They've gone from a handful of people in one city to 7 million people all over the known world. I have no idea. She asked, how did they estimate that? I think the way that they do is by, when you get to the Council of Nicaea is represented by a certain number of churches in a certain number of areas, and they do that based on population of known areas. You got any additional information there on how you would estimate number of Christians at the Council of Nicaea?
That's about the right way. If you look at the structure of the parishes that are out there,
yeah.
The harder number is the ones from Pentecost to Nicaea.
Yeah.
And there's about four or five sociological explanations on how they
were. For the recording, what Garrett said was, you look at the parishes, basically those represented at the councils, but that number between Pentecost and Council of Nicaea is much harder to estimate than post-Nicaea. Once we get past Nicaea, the numbers are a lot easier to gauge. So, as I mentioned, more Gentile and less Jewish brings in greater persecutions. We saw last week, and this is starting with B instead of A, limited persecutions in the first century had taken place under Emperors Claudius, Nero, and Domitian. And in all those cases, the persecutions were pretty localized. The emperors were in Rome, and so the victims of much of those persecutions were in Rome. If you lived in the outlying areas or if you lived in other parts of the Roman world, it wasn't as big a deal. But certainly Rome was a dangerous place to be. We move into the second century, you see the identity of the church starts to really create some issues in the Roman Empire, and this is where they're listed in A. Christianity was branded as an illegal religion in the Roman Empire. Christians refused to worship the emperor of Rome. And it wasn't as much that the Romans really believed that their emperor was a god. That's good old Egyptian theology. The Egyptians, old pharaohs, they really believed Pharaoh was God. But your willingness to worship the emperor as a god was a sign of your patriotism, your commitment to the empire. And if you refused to do so, then what did that indicate? You're kind of a traitor, yeah. You'll see down under, well, later on there, the word treason is offered. You were viewed as an unpatriotic, you know, stomping on the American flag and burning Christian Bibles, and that was kind of the attitude. And so it's often thought that the worst of the Roman leaders, the most vile and corrupt ones, were the ones that persecuted the Christians. In reality, it really was the stronger, more effective leaders of the Roman Empire that persecuted the Christians, because they were advocating a strong commitment to the empire. And they were troubled most by this group of Christians who refused to acknowledge the emperor of the empire as deity or as a god. Thirdly, Christians refused to participate in any social activities that were connected to pagan gods. Work guilds, athletic events, just social life in general, feasts, banquets, weddings, funerals. The last time I was in Oaxaca, we went and visited a family in one of the tribal villages outside the city. They were the only people that were Christians in an entire town, an entire village, and they would not go to funerals because the town was predominantly Catholic, but it was very much more a pagan version of Catholicism. And at their funerals, there was so many forms of ancestor worship that they refused to go to the funerals. And as such, had become ostracized from their village, had a hard time getting food, had a hard time finding work. And we kind of talked through with them through, you know, how you can go to a funeral and support the families and share your condolences, but then, you know, if later on there are rituals to the dead and to ancestors, excuse yourself from that. How is it that you live here and engage, but also speak the truth, you know, represent your testimony? Even today, that's today, same kind of stuff was going on back then. They just, when we say remove themselves from social life, it doesn't seem like that big a deal, but it really was. But all of those things, usually there were sacrifices to pagan gods of the Roman/Greek pantheon, sacrifices, worship, burning of incense, all kinds of things to pagan gods. And so that put Christians usually on the ill side of governmental leaders and their neighbors, just people in general. Numerous false charges were brought against them, including atheism. They don't have any visible representation of God, therefore they must not believe in a God. You see where the good old Hebrew scriptures of not making a form of God kind of came back to bite them in the backside there. Treason, because they would refuse, they wouldn't worship the emperor. Licentiousness and immorality are both on that list. The way they talked about, their worship services were secret. Oh, you had to be a Christian to come. And they referred to one another as brothers and sisters, and they talked about this agape love, which in the Greek world was very, you know, broad and could include all kinds of things, and they wouldn't let anybody come in and see what was going on. And so rumors just started going all over the place about what kinds of immoral, improper, incestuous kinds of things that these Christians would do in their secret worship services. Their language, the way they talked about things, caused them problems. Not only with their worship, but also with the Lord's Supper. They'd have these suppers where they'd talk about eating the body and drinking the blood of their Messiah. In fact, there was one writing that even talked about, because the church was usually known for taking in infants, if infants would be found in places, they would take them in. And that the hospitality or generosity of taking in babies or infants that had been abandoned, and their language about these feasts where they were eating bodies and drinking blood, you know, the Romans kind of put those two things together and came up with all kinds of horror stories about what the Christians were doing with these babies that they'd found. Yeah. Bad stuff. And so accused of cannibalism, immorality, haters of humanity and culture because of their absence from social activities. And lastly, the majority of Christians in the church were from lesser educated, more working class parts of society. And so some of it was just a class prejudice against the aristocrats, the more elite. How can these lesser educated people claim to have some version of truth that we, the educated, the wealthy, the important, don't have? You take all these things and put them all in these communities around the Roman Empire, and what do you think happened? Christians were not popular, and usually they suffered all manner of persecution, even from just a social world. Like we mentioned, hard time having jobs. If you have a place of business, a hard time getting customers. We experienced this a little bit on whenever we go to Israel and we go into Bethlehem, Palestinian territory. And what we'll do is we'll go buy souvenirs from the one or two Christian-owned and run tourist shops, because the only people that they get business from in predominantly Islamic Palestine are Christian tourists that come through, because the other people in their city won't support them, won't come and invest dollars there. And so very much, again, we see it going on in the second century Roman Empire. It still goes on today, even if it doesn't take place here. It set Christians up for a new wave of persecutions to come. Around 111, Emperor Trajan, in correspondence with Pliny the Younger. How do you say his name, Gary? You say Pliny or do you say Pliny?
I say Pliny.
You say Pliny. Is there a correct way, or is... Yeah, it's take your pick. So, Pliny the Younger, or Pliny the Younger, as you prefer, was governor of Bithynia, which was one of the Roman provinces on the northern shore of Turkey, and he was already in the context of persecuting Christians because of accusations made by people, but he started investigating it and realized that a lot of these claims were not true, and so he began to be troubled by imprisoning or even executing Christians based on these ridiculous claims, and so he writes to the emperor and says, what should we do? And so Emperor Trajan's response, and this would become the basic Roman way of dealing with Christians for the next 100, 150 years or even more. He says, there is no single uniform rule. That in and of itself is trouble. You can kind of interpret it based on whatever your circumstances are. He does say that the state really shouldn't expend resources, energy, effort at hunting down Christians in order to imprison them. They don't appear to be hurting anything. They don't appear to be causing any problems. We don't need to be spending a lot of effort hunting them down. But if an accusation is made and someone is brought before you and accused of being a Christian and they will not recant from their faith, then we must punish them because they are showing insubordination to the state. So we're not doing it based on religious things they've done in the past, but if they've come before the court and they will not acknowledge Caesar as God and they will not offer sacrifices to the gods of the Roman Empire and they will not recant Christ, then they are stubborn, they are insubordinate, they are treasonous, and they must be punished, i.e., in most cases, put to death. If they will worship the Roman gods or offer sacrifices and curse Christ, then they'll be pardoned. That's all you have to do. And a very wise thing, he said anonymous accusations would not be heeded. They would be disregarded because we could get ourselves into all kinds of, if you don't like somebody and you want to get back at them, just accuse them of being a Christian. So anonymous accusations don't fly. So what it set up was this scenario where, if you can imagine that environment, if that was us living here, and persecution would only come if somebody in your circle of influence, if you get on the wrong side of them, and they want to get back at you, and they go make an accusation. If nobody makes an accusation against you, then no persecution is going to come your way. The temptation would either be just to live your life as a Christian and not talk about it and not let anybody know and not tell anybody. But that was very much against the evangelism mandate of the early church. And so, but if you do it, if you get on the wrong side of your neighbor, you get on the wrong side of somebody across town, and they want to get back at you, all they had to do was go to the local government and accuse you of being a Christian, and then it's on. Yeah, then it's on. Then you find out whether you'll stand for what you believe or not. We're going to have some challenging discussions in Hebrews on Sundays coming up. Hebrews chapter 6 is going to talk very candidly about the possibility of, or if it's a possibility, of people leaving the faith. Can you abandon your faith? As Baptists, we typically hold to a doctrine of once saved, always saved. Reformed theology would call it the perseverance of the saints. Security of the believer is another name for it. The early writers of Scripture, I mean, and you have Hebrews that'll talk about people leaving the faith, and then you'll have John in his letter will say, well, if they left the faith, then they never really were part of us to begin with. And so it's a very, very difficult doctrine. But in the second century in the early church, you had people that had agreed to follow Christ, that had become a part of the church, that had gotten baptized, and then when they were faced with persecution, abandoned the church and went back to their ways of living as a Roman citizen. Now, we can quarrel behind the scenes as to what was really going on. Did they lose their salvation? Were they ever really saved to begin with? Had they chosen this and now they chose this? The words we use to describe it are important for theology, but for history's sake, there are lots of examples of people when faced with death, worship Caesar and recant Christ, or we're going to execute you. People by the drove said, I like living, and so I'll do what you say. And that's indeed what happened. So Emperor Trajan and Pliny the Younger, that's an important correspondence, important dialogue there. Later in the second century, Marcus Aurelius, which is a name known by many, came to rule in Rome for a period of about 20 years. He was considered a great emperor, an enlightened attitude, but despite all of that, was very biased against Christians because he saw them as traitors. And so persecution levels rose again under Marcus Aurelius towards the end of the second century. Comments, questions up to this point. We're going to see a few of the notable martyrs during the second century of the early church. Yeah. None. Yeah, the question was, how much of that original correspondence between Pliny and Trajan is extant? And I think it is, I don't know the answer. Do you?
Well, Pliny has, if you look it up, he's got a volume of stuff.
Okay.
Or he has a volume of works.
Okay, so that would be the place to look.
There are of similar size to Josephus.
Okay. Okay. What he said was Pliny has a collection of writings of a historical variety from a Roman perspective, sort of what Josephus represents from a Jewish perspective. And so that would be, Rusty, that's what I would do is look.
So the way we know about it then is not necessarily from the writings, but from the edicts that came out?
That would be my guess. And it's probably referenced in his writings if it's not given specifically this form. On the back of your notes, I pointed out later, but I'll go ahead and draw your attention to it now. There's some websites where you can go. A lot of these early writers, their documents, letters, writings are available for free. They're public domain. You can go to Barnes & Noble and buy them. You can get on Amazon and buy them, but you can also get online and get them for free if you want to go and read or look into some of these. So that's a resource that may be worth checking out. Notable martyrs during the second century. First is Ignatius, Bishop of Antioch. Ignatius was martyred around 107 under Trajan. From Antioch, he was arrested and tried, and they decided, there was a big festival in Rome, they decided it would be entertaining to have him executed in Rome. And so he took a voyage kind of like Paul did to Rome. And on the way, he authored 7 letters that we do have. They're extant. And sent to different churches and different people. And so they're considered some very informative and valuable writings of the early church. One of those letters he wrote was to Polycarp, who is the second guy on our list. About 50 years later, he was martyred under Antoninus Pius. I want it to be Antonius, but it's not. Polycarp was a friend of Ignatius, a recipient of one of his 7 letters, and he also authored a letter to the Philippians that is extant. The word extant, that means we have it. There's some that we know about but are lost. If it's extant, that means we have access to it. So, thirdly, Justin Martyr. And Justin Martyr is an important guy. He operated a school of Christian philosophy in Rome, and around 165 was martyred under the persecutions of Marcus Aurelius. He's also counted among the early apologists, which is where we'll get to under big Roman numeral number 3. Ignatius of Antioch, I presume that's Antioch where Paul was from, Antioch, Syrian Antioch, not Antioch of Pisidia. Ignatius, Polycarp, and Justin Martyr, 3 notable ones. Certainly not the only ones, but all 3 of them were men who wrote some, and who we have writings that you can get online or you can go pick up and read today. We don't consider them canonical, but they're incredibly valuable. And so if you'd like to read more from them, you can do so. Anything there? Any of Ignatius's letters you really like? One of his letters, the letter he wrote to the church in Rome, is generally considered to be one of the most valuable of the 7 letters that he wrote.
I would just say that his stuff that he what he was writing on his way to martyrdom,
yeah.
Which is, as you mentioned, it's really critical. But there's a lot of neat things that are a part of the Ignatian correspondence where you can pick up that were just sort of going on around the time. And as he gets closer to Rome, and he knows what he's getting closer to, it's sort of interesting to watch chronologically how his fervor for the gospel explodes to a degree. And he gets more interested in communicating passionately to these churches that they must go on and do this work that's so important.
I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was Ignatius who, in his letter to the church at Rome, acknowledged that there were rumors that Christians in Rome were going to try and free him, and he encouraged them not to do so, that he was ready and committed to die for his belief, trusting and hoping that his sacrifice would encourage others and lead to the growth of the church. Was that Ignatius or was that somebody else?
I think it's Polycarp.
Might have been Polycarp.
Yeah, it's Polycarp. Yeah. That it fits his
in the letter to the
yeah. his, it fits his ideas a little bit better. Yeah.
One of the things that Garrett mentioned, you know, these writings of these guys, some of it we can glean theology from it, but really the most valuable content in these writings is it gives us a window into what life was like in the church during that time period. It helps you see the struggles that they were dealing with, the challenges, their way of thinking. And so if you're really interested in more of the, you know, the historical world that the church was living in around the second century, that'd be of great value for those purposes. So yeah, question. His name was not Justin Martyr. He's referred to, I think it's referred to there as Justin the Martyr. Yeah, his given name was
Justin.
Justin, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Martyr comes from the Greek martyrus.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and which martyr really, it doesn't have anything to do with dying. The word martyr is the Greek word for witness. And so there's something really ironic with the fact that the word for witness came to be associated with those who would die for their faith. Somewhat profound. Well, if there are all these false accusations being made, if your neighbor could say, well, Betty's a cannibal because she's taken the Lord's Supper, and that could lead to trouble, then there arose a need for leaders within the church to defend what the church was doing and explain to people why these false accusations were not true. And that's where this letter of writers, this category of writers we refer to as the apologists, emerged. Their sole purpose, their identity of the writings really is to deal with single issues. Paul's letters are much the same. You know, we don't have a systematic theology from Paul. We have a letter to the Philippians about encouraging one another and standing firm. We have a letter to the Corinthians about arguing and fighting amongst one another. We have a letter, you know, to the Galatians about standing firm in the light of Judaistic teachings. He deals with issues as they come up. There's a problem here, I'll address it. There's an issue here, I'll address it. That's what the apologists would do. In their context, there's a problem with misunderstanding of this matter or this matter or this matter. And so they would deal with issues as they arose. You see on Roman numeral 3, since persecution primarily came on Christians if their neighbors turned them into authorities, it was very important for the anti-Nicene church members to foster good relationships with those neighbors. In addition, there was great need for the church to defend itself against the numerous false claims made about them. To this task, a number of writers or apologists sought to defend the church. Among the apologists, there were two paths. Some followed a path of radical opposition to classical and pagan culture. The idea was that many heresies within the church rose out of attempts to unite pagan philosophy and Christian doctrine. A second path looked for a more synthetic approach, identifying where Christian doctrine and classical philosophies had common observations. You can see both of these paths still today in the way the church engages culture. There are those within the church who say we should refrain from anything that isn't Christian music, Christian movies, Christian books, Christian this, Christian that, Christian this. If it is secular, if it is not specifically aimed at the Christian community or the Christian world, then we should refrain from it. We stand opposed to it. And then you have, you know, Christian blog writers that'll go, you know, go watch every movie that comes out and write about spiritual themes or observations or things that take place in this or that or the other. I firmly represent the second path here, in case you didn't know. But both paths have their value, and part of the reason is understanding what was going on in the world around them. We return to Justin Martyr here at small letter C, because he was the chief exemplar in the second century of the synthetic approach. In other words, he looked at the classical philosophies of Aristotle, Socrates, Plato, and some of the things they talked about. They're talking about a supreme being. They're talking about the immortality of the soul. They're talking about that the things of this world are shadows, and there is a real, spiritual, perfect realm or world somewhere else. And Justin Martyr hears these ideas that the Greek philosophers were wrestling with, and he says, that sounds a whole lot like the Hebrew Scriptures. That sounds a lot like the Old Testament. Maybe they didn't have all the details right. Maybe they were missing out on some of the important nuances. But if truth is truth, then, you know, maybe the Greek philosophers were at least fishing in the right pond, so to speak. They were, again, we talked last week how they criticized the gods of the Greek pantheon. They questioned creating the gods in the image of man. And so Justin Martyr, he looked for a synthetic approach. He pointed out philosophical ideas like the supreme being, immortality, a supernatural realm beyond the creation were similar with the teachings of the Christian scriptures. He did point out that classical philosophy fell short of full truth. In other words, he wasn't complete, you know, joining of Greek philosophy, but also that the great classical philosophers had more in common with Christianity than with pagan Roman religion. As the Christians were being persecuted by Rome because they were said to be an illegal religion and they were against the Roman gods, Justin Martyr would stand back and say, the classical philosophers that you champion had more in common with me than they did you. They were closer to where I am than they are worshiping Jupiter or worshiping the emperor. In fact, they were entirely against worshiping the emperors. Justin's extant writings are three. There's the First Apology, there's the Dialogue with Trypho, and On the Resurrection. Many of his other writings, we know he wrote a lot. Many of his others are lost to history. And as we mentioned, he was martyred under Marcus Aurelius. The second example represents more of the radical opposition camp. Tatian was a student of Justin Martyr. He was an apologist like Justin Martyr, but he did not take a synthetic path. He took an opposition path. He claimed that everything the Romans and Greeks learned, they took from the so-called barbarians. That's that class prejudice thing we mentioned earlier. The elite in Rome would say that the Christians can't be right because they're just barbarians. They're peons, they're slaves, they're menial workers. And Tatian would say, well, everything that the Romans and Greeks have learned and believed they took from the barbarians, astronomy from the Babylonians, geometry from the Egyptians, writing from the Phoenicians, and wisdom from the Hebrews. He says Moses predates Plato. Moses even predates Homer, who wrote about the Greek gods. And so anything that those two have towards wisdom, they just got from, whether they took it directly from the Hebrew scriptures. He says that Moses was writing about these things long before Homer was, or long before Plato was. And so even their wisdom came from the Hebrews, even if they took those things and distorted their truths. So Tatian is another of the apologists. The third really important apologist is Tertullian. And Tertullian wrote very widely, and we've included him in the next section under teachers, but Tertullian is good to know as far as apologists go as well. Some others, Aristides, Athenagoras, and Theophilus in the second century, Origen, who we'll mention here in a moment as well, writing in Greek in the third century, and then Tertullian and Minucius Felix writing in the Latin language in the 3rd century. Writings of Justin Martyr and Tatian and Tertullian, you can access those on these digital websites. They're not easy reading. If you tried to read Josephus, I mean, reading anything, if you tried to read the Iliad and the Odyssey, you know, it's kind of slow, methodical reading. But if you just want to sample a little bit, then that kind of gives you an idea. Justin Martyr really working from wedding Greek philosophy, classical philosophy, and Christian doctrine. Tatian really separating Christian doctrine from the Roman and Greek world. Anything you want to add, Garrett, on Justin Martyr or Tatian or the Apologists? Any questions? Second century guys. In addition to defending defending rumors, one of the other things that started emerging in the second century, as you have these communities scattered all over the Roman world, different people teaching different things, you also have some of these sect kind of spin-off groups that start forming different sets of beliefs that came to be viewed as heresy. Sometimes it was a specific teacher, sometimes it was a group of people. The Gnostics is one of those groups that many people know of. Marcion is another one. And you have this whole range of heretical ideas and teachings start emerging. And then from that, the church also is responding, not just from persecution outside the apologists, but also from heresies inside the church. They're fighting a war on two fronts. They're fighting Rome and the persecutions on the outside. They're fighting heretical teachings and doctrinal orthodoxy on the inside. And so the apologists are defending, they're writing, defending from false rumors on the outside. This group of teachers referred to as the polemicists are going to begin. They say, well, if we don't have laid out a good doctrinal description of what we believe, then why are we surprised whenever Marcion comes up and does something weird or some other teacher comes up and teaches something false? We need to have a good description of what Christian doctrine is. Not issue by issue, but as a whole, what we believe. This was one response to the heresies. Other responses to the heresies include canonizing the scriptures. It includes defining and writing some creeds that the church would buy into. Next week's lecture is going to be much more involved in heresies, who they were, what they claimed, and some of the other responses, including canonization of the New Testament, including the creeds of the early church. The polemicists are what are represented here under Roman numeral number 4. The leaders that would write larger doctrinal treatises trying to give the church a grounding that would stand not in place of Scripture, but describe the church's interpretation of Scripture and hopefully protect the church from heresy. I think that first paragraph is kind of what I just said. As the church continued to spread, a number of heretical ideas and systems sprung up. Early church leaders led the church as a whole in a variety of responses to these questionable beliefs and practices. One response was the process of writing out more extensive doctrinal statements outlining what indeed was correct orthodox doctrine for Christians. And so we've listed 4 of these people for you. Yes? Polemicist, P-O-L-E-M-I-C-I-S-T. Polemics, which represents teaching, I believe. What's the etymology of polemics? Yeah. Anybody? Anybody know? Does anybody know what etymology is? Origins of words. The origin, the word origin. Irenaeus. He's another I. I get Ignatius and Irenaeus mixed up. Ignatius, martyred, wrote letters. Irenaeus was a pastor, believed to be a native of Smyrna, which is one of the 7 letters in Revelation. He heard Polycarp as a boy who was martyred, which probably Polycarp was linked to John the Apostle, So we have this link from John to Polycarp to Irenaeus. Became bishop of the church in Lyon, modern-day France. Mainly a pastor who wrote to refute heresies and instruct believers. If you reverse 4 and 5, his big deal was God's purpose is to draw mankind into unity with himself. And so he took the scriptures and showed how God progressively unfolded his purpose from the Old Testament down to the incarnation of Jesus. And the purpose of what God has done throughout history, leading up to the present day, to what Christ had done, even into the future, all of this is designed to draw humanity back into unity with God, into a right relationship with God. That sounds almost like stuff we teach today, right? Yeah, not bad. Writings of Irenaeus are available. I don't think there are a ton of them, but he does have a few extant writings. Keep in mind where he was located, in Lyon, in the west, but he was from Smyrna, modern-day Turkey. Next, Clement of Alexandria, circa 115 to 215. I'm sorry, 150 to 215. Clement, born in Athens to pagan parents, converted to Christianity at a young age, and in his search for a Christian teacher, found himself in Alexandria. He made it from Athens, from Greece to Egypt. He learned under a teacher that we don't know much about, a Christian teacher named Panteneus, and then succeeded him as instructor of the school at Alexandria around 190. Clement was very much like Justin Martyr. I see truths in the classical philosophies paralleled with truths in Scripture. And he worked at identifying the two, putting them together. Clement also used allegorical interpretation extensively, maybe even incorrectly. Anything he could do to show how Plato and Aristotle appear in scriptures through allegories, symbolic interpretations, really at the extreme of sensibility, he would do so. Thirdly, Tertullian, we mentioned earlier, wrote some apologies. Also wrote some polemics. 160 to 225, was born in Carthage, raised in a pagan family, became a well-educated lawyer, skilled in legal thinking and rhetoric, and then around the age of 37 became a Christian. Because of his upbringing, his rhetoric skills, his legal mind, he wrote many treatises against internal heresies, many of which are extant today. You can find all kinds of stuff written by Tertullian. His central polemical thought was this: truth is that which the church maintains. In other words, if people are spreading random ideas and it is beyond the realm of what the church agrees generally to be orthodox, then you should be careful. You should be careful. This arose the big question of who is in charge of orthodoxy. And he put it on the church. The church controls orthodoxy. In his age, this was really important. 1,500 years later, during the time of the Reformation, guess what the Roman Catholic Church is going to use against all of those that would be reformers? Tertullian. The church is the governor of orthodoxy, and we are the church, and you are wrong. And of course, it didn't pan out as well. A different context, different issues, but that's the way Tertullian kind of lived on, you know, even centuries after his time. Later, the interesting thing is, later he became a Montanist, a follower of a gentleman named Montanus, that was somewhat of a heretic himself. Montanus believed that in him, we had moved to a new stage in the elevation of salvation, that Jesus was one level and now we've advanced to the next level. And followers need to be even more rigidly moral and ethical than they've been before. Writers seem to think that Tertullian, because of his rigid legal mind, which some of you that are engineers might could empathize with, he kept looking around at the church and some of its struggles and some of its immorality and some of the imprecision in the way the church worked, and he just was troubled by that. And he kept looking for something that was a little bit more perfect, a little bit more rigid, a little bit more defined. And some writers even suggest that later in his life, what he was looking for in the Montanists he didn't find. And so he left the Montanists and formed his own kind of sectarian group of Christians that he called the Tertullianists, that were trying to be just as rigidly moral as they could possibly be. Thank you. 7:10. Real quick, a couple of things later, and Tertullian, you need to know, in his later writings, he's the first to talk about the Trinity in this language, that God is one substance and three persons. We still talk about God as one God and three persons. That goes back to Tertullian. And secondly, that he talked about Christ as one person with two natures, both divine and human. And so he has influenced the way we still talk about theology with the Trinity and with the nature of Christ today. Fourthly, Origen, born in Alexandria to a Christian family. His father was martyred, studied in Alexandria under Clement, and then succeeded him. Ended up in Caesarea, wrote extensively. He was orthodox on major matters, but very influenced by Platonistic philosophy on others. This last paragraph we'll wrap up with. It's really interesting to think about these theologians. These are the first great theologians of the church. First, Irenaeus reflects the sort of theology that will become dominant in his native area of Asia Minor, as well as in Syria. Theology dominated by the story of what God has done, is doing, and will do. It sees salvation as union with Christ who has conquered death, a union established by baptism and fed by communion. Secondly, particularly in Alexandria, a theological trend is emerging whose main concern is to show the connection between Christianity and the best of classical philosophy. This theology is dominated by the quest for philosophical unchanging truth. For it, salvation consists in being so illumined by God as to be able to return to the spiritual world. Finally, in the Latin-speaking West, Tertullian is the first exponent of a theology that will be profoundly concerned over moral issues, sometimes to the point of legalism, and for which salvation is attained by moral purity. In later centuries, these three theologies would continue evolving. The Latin-speaking West, dominated by a theological outlook patterned after Tertullian's, would be involved in repeated debates on how to preserve the purity of the church, and much later, particularly in the 16th century, over the role of works in salvation. The Greek-speaking East would soon be divided by differences reflecting the tradition expounded by Irenaeus on the one hand, feeling, mysticism, union with God, and the philosophical outlook of Origen on the other, academia, reason, rationality, thinking. Very interesting. Three different streams of theology based on what was going on in three different parts of the world. And as we sit here as Christians today, we see the influence of all of those on our own faith, on our own life, and how they exist in different proportions, depending on whether you're Baptist, whether you're Presbyterian, whether you're Catholic, whether you're charismatic. The unity with God in the charismatic gifts that so predominates in one area, the Bible study, the rationalism in Presbyterian and Baptist life, the moral ritual following of traditions that Roman Catholic life takes. All three, and yet all three trace their roots back to the early church. And really all three ought to be part of all of our faiths. But churches in different parts of the world throughout history kind of elevate one of these over the other two in different parts of their spiritual life. And so the challenge for us, I think, is to look for balance in all of these.